It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. Good to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Just as President Trump was announcing that executive order that was aimed at helping historically black colleges and universities, often called HBCUs, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos sent out a statement, and in it she called HBCUs real pioneers when it comes to school choice. Those were her words. Now, she walked that back after a storm of criticism, but this raises some bigger questions at the end of Black History Month. Leslie Joy Allen is an historian and oral historian at Georgia State University, where she's a doctoral candidate. Welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Betsy DeVos episode came in the very last days of Black History Month, and we've observed Black History Month officially in this country since 1976. So the bigger question is, do we have any way to determine whether Black History Month has actually gotten through to people, whether it's improved our knowledge?
Well, it's improved the knowledge for people that are actually interested. I've said this many times, when people don't feel like they have a vested interest in something, they tend to turn it off or tune it out. And Black History Month, unfortunately, while it may have been necessary, I still remember when it was a week and then it became a month when I was a teenager. But unfortunately, it's becomes rather parochial. It's been a parade of big names.
The Mount Rushmore,
the what we historians on college levels call the big man, big woman history. And unfortunately, it doesn't do a lot with public history and community history, where you look at ordinary, or what people would refer to as ordinary, people's lives. I don't think anybody is ordinary. Mm-hmm. But it dismisses a whole segment of the population.
So in other words, if you look just at what Dr. King did, because he's so prominent in Black History Month, mm-hmm. without looking at the forces that affected the lives of people whose names we'll never know, you really don't understand not only society, but you probably don't understand Dr. King.
That's absolutely true. The problem here is that the focus tends to be on people that make the news. School teachers, bus drivers, lawyers, accountants, people that just go to work every day, they mind their manners, they pay their bills. These are the people affected by these policies. And one of the good things about being an oral historian is that we do go out and find people whose names are not in newspapers to fully flesh out this policy. Oral history is relatively new as a discipline. It's taken a while for it to earn some real respect, because there's a tendency in the Western world to want everything written down. If it's not on paper, it isn't real. But I have found in the main that we get a much bigger picture when we talk to people like Martin Luther King Jr.'s secretary, who remembers when she went out and got him a morning suit because he was going to Oslo, Norway, and he didn't know what a morning suit was.
Mm-hmm. And Oslo, Norway was where he got his Nobel Peace Prize.
But she talked about how he said, I'm not going to wear this thing. I'm going to look stupid in it. These are the kinds of stories that humanize him, that humanize people who are technically legends now. And there's a danger in becoming a legend.
Now, in the Betsy DeVos statement, you've had a chance to read the whole thing. I only quoted one sentence of it, the one that got all the attention.
Mm-hmm.
Was the problem that you had in reading it what was in there or what wasn't in there?
The statement was actually fine. What wasn't included was the reason for the necessity of historically black colleges. Historically black colleges were created, and they were created below the Mason-Dixon line for two reasons. One, that's where the majority of black people were. Two, white northerners did not particularly want this wave of black intelligentsia arriving in the north. This is why you have so many of them in the south. And they were always racially integrated, anybody that wanted to come. When it comes to school choice, I don't know how big of a choice every black student had, because the objective was initially, we only have about a tenth of black Americans that are going to go to school, which comes from that phrase, the talented tenth. And Du Bois did not coin it. A man by the name of Samuel Morehouse, whom Morehouse is named for, coined it. And the idea was, you're going to get the ones that can be well-educated will become well-educated, and then they will direct and control the black community. So choice is a dicey term here.
It raises the question, though, of, for all of the years that we've been observing Black History Month, how much of what you just talked about, the struggles of a whole community, has actually gotten through not only to the wider community, but even to the African-American community itself?
I don't think it gets through. I think it gets through the people that are already interested in it. There are many, many times as a historian when you're in a classroom or you're doing something like this where you know you're sort of preaching to the choir. The good news is that in most college and university history courses, African-Americans are not always separated out. You can take courses in African-American history, but in the main, when I teach at Georgia State, I've taught on three campuses. Everybody's included as much as possible. Now, there's no such thing as comprehensive history. We can't write everything. But I think what happens in Black History Month is that you have this wave of celebration of Black people have done exceptional things. And it basically makes Black people and a few other people feel better to know this and that, but it doesn't necessarily teach you anything, because the reality is that your mother and father and the neighbors that you know, regardless of whether or not their names were in the newspaper, they probably have had a bigger impact on your life and made sacrifices and stood for things that they're never going to get any credit for. And I often mention this. Sometimes it's to keep me from nutting up. Most people, if I say, what was the best motion picture in 2009? And they have to go look it up. But if you ask anybody, who was your favorite teacher or who was the adult that you think had the biggest impact, it typically comes just like that. Those are the people that I think in many instances are left out of this larger narrative during Black History Month. And that's what oral history historians do, is try to put those people back in so that people understand that everybody is important, and they are.
Black History Month itself is just a combination of thousands of observances around the country. But just speaking generally here, what is missing from much of Black History Month that ought to be there?
For one, public history, community histories, neighborhoods that thrived and survived during particular periods, people that got things done. I think there's this unfortunate tendency, particularly when you talk about the civil rights movement, that everybody gets the idea that 24/7, all day long, the only thing people, Black people are thinking about is whether they're going to make it to the march, whether somebody white is going to throw a rock at them. And the truth of the matter is that we raised families and children. We had parties. We went to concerts, fashion shows, community block parties. There was a lot of things going on while all of this chaos that you probably saw on the news. If you were growing up, when I was growing up, you saw people throwing rocks and bottles. You saw the National Guard come out. There were safe places for all of us. The biggest untold story is the story of Black parenting, where your parents tell you what to do and what not to do, and they do it in a way where they don't strip you of your humanity. And I think that story, Jeanetta Cole, former president of Spelman, brought that up quite nicely. What do you tell your child when they see a sign that says whites only? How do you navigate that and not strip them of their self-esteem? And I think that's a story that absolutely positively needs to be told.
Yet you hear folks in the majority community, some folks say, well, why do we have Black history? Because everybody should just be an American. I'm sure you've heard that argument. And yet part of the argument of Black History Month is, yes, we are raising our children in society just like everybody else. So how do you answer when folks raise that point?
And there isn't an easy answer to that question, because for a very long time, I don't know what shape most public school systems are in, but Black history was something that was relegated to a week. Black studies.
And separated out.
Carter G. Woodson started this not because he wanted us to have a Black History Month or Black History Week. The goal was to include the contributions and the participation of African Americans in society, to a point where it would just simply become a part of the larger narrative. And so I think what happens is that even though we've made a lot of progress in terms of that, there you can find black studies and books about African-American life all over the place. But the reality is that there is a dichotomy here. On the one hand, we are Americans. I don't know. I've been black my whole life, so I can speak of our patriotism. But the reality is that we have had a sort of subculture and a separate culture. And so it goes back to Du Bois' two-ness. You know, at once you feel
W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah, the dual consciousness where you are also black, you're also American. But those two things don't always come together very neatly where you can just simply say that you're an American. Toni Morrison made a statement about we're hyphenated Americans because we're the people that you're trying to fit in. Women often find the stories about their lives. There's this tendency to everybody's used that term, oh, you're a lady doctor. And all that means is that you expect a doctor to be a man. So we have made some progress, but I think Black History Month would be more productive and would catch the attention of more people if it included the stories of citizens that know they're never going to be in a newspaper, they're never going to be in a magazine or probably a book, but they know that they have made a contribution to building a family, a community, an organization, and they get no credit for it.
How do you do that, though, in a school curriculum, let's say, where you're supposed to know the basic facts about the big headliners, and you're going to include them anyway, but how do you work those individual stories into a school curriculum and then maybe have a test on it?
Well, to be honest with you, one of my goals is to create oral history workshops where I can teach individuals the techniques of oral history, because there is a way to do it where you get more information, and there's another way to do it where you come back and say, I don't think I asked the right questions. A lot of people that I've talked to that have done these interviews that didn't want to hire me to be oral and said, I don't think I asked the right questions. I said, you probably didn't. But the first place you always start with history is with the oldest member of your family. And that's usually your grandmother or your grandfather. It could be your mom, you know. But these are the things we have to emphasize that, though. And what we are dealing with right now, we emphasize bling bling, people with a lot of money, people that make the most provocative statements, people that have the biggest jobs. And the news media, education, all of us are responsible for reframing the narrative, where people who think that they don't have a voice actually have one. The town hall meetings are a darn good place to start because these people want to talk and they have an axe to grind.
What would you say to someone who grew up 40, 50 years ago who remembers a time when black history was not taught at all? When, for instance, Dr. King couldn't even get recognition in his own home state, even as he was getting a Nobel Peace Prize, who say, look, you're forgetting why Black History Month and Black History Week before it started in the first place.
That's a hard one, because I remember when there wasn't. I went to private parochial school, and I think one of the advantages of that in Atlanta, I can't speak for parochial systems all around the country, is that they tended, it's seemingly contradictory, you know, in a lot of ways, but Catholic education has often been more inclusive of other cultures, other peoples, than other systems. So we were reading things that were technically banned by the Atlanta public school system and other school systems. The dilemma is trying to insist that people read some things that they may not like. That's the hard part about this. A lot of people that I know, including classmates, you know, I said, and I may get myself into trouble on WABE, but I read Death of the West by Patrick Buchanan. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I read it is...
Former speechwriter for President Nixon, leading voice in the conservative movement.
And somebody said, why did you do that? I said, because that's a bigot, you know, but the reality is he's a smart one. And he tells you what he's afraid of. And in truth, He really, I remember Malcolm X, I remember watching him say, we're not going to solve anything until a white man can sit down with a black man and they tell each other exactly how they feel. And what's happened is, I don't want to sound like I'm totally anti-political correctness, but what's happened is people will mask their feelings in what they think is appropriate language, which is what I think the new education secretary did. She just conveniently left out that particular piece. It's not the worst statement I've read, but it is a statement that doesn't address a specific reality as to why those historically black colleges and universities were created in the first place. And if a white person is afraid to tell a black person what they think and vice versa, then we have a conversation that mutes where we are really trying to go. Because people do have legitimate, even if the fear is unfounded, it's still a fear you have to address. So when I read the book, when our current president won, I said, this guy was talking about all of these fears back in 2002. You know, if you talk to extraordinary people, I'm not going to call them ordinary, you will find out what they think as opposed to what a historian or a journalist tells them to think. And that's the part of the story that I think is left out. And the best way to do it, I think, is to have some open forums, invite people in that don't have any particular title. They just simply have something to say. And I'm hoping you guys will do it. I slipped that one in on you.
So the bottom line is, it's complicated.
It's complicated. It's not impossible, but people tend to, I will reiterate, people tend to, if it's something on television and you don't think it's something you want to watch or you don't think it has anything to do with you, you change the channel.
You
got choices now. I mean, it's not required to take African American history. You have to take U.S. history. I think there's a world history component. And I think when I was finishing up finally, you had to take some African history, some Asian history, some European history to get some balance. But not everybody's a historian. And so that's oftentimes my dilemma, is trying to figure out what people know and what they don't know. Because a lot of times you're hammering them with stuff and they're like, what are you talking about? I've never heard of this stuff. And that's where oral history really helps you. Because when you talk to folks who are not in academe or who are not in media, who are not in something that is directly related to this, you find out bits and pieces of what they think, what they know, and what they don't know. And one of the things that's bugged me for a long time, particularly about the whole notion of African American history, period, African Americans' history, it was a statement that Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, who's a historian and founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock, stated. She said, most of what we do as a people, there's no such place as Afro-America. We don't have a set of boundaries. Like other people from Northern Ireland, you know where it begins, where it ends. We did not receive land after slavery. So she said, the business of building a people has been cultural. This is why the arts, this is why music, everybody all around the world knows Aretha Franklin. They may not know a guy that's playing a sitar in India, but they know James Brown. They know our actors. They know our dance. They know our food. So there's always been this nagging thing with me that we don't pay enough attention to the arts as we should. And I think we walk a fine line there, because there are black people who say, well, you know, everybody thinks we can sing. Everybody thinks we can dance. So you're dealing with, how do you tell the story without telling that, though? Because that was most cultures, including back in the Roman Empire, the people that lived at the margins tended to go into the arts and sports because it was the most open place to go. So we went into those things. And so I think we're sometimes at war with ourselves, because a lot of times somebody brought up a situation at a school for Black History Month. Somebody made fried chicken and collard greens, and they had macaroni and cheese. And I heard some black person just go absolutely nut up. That's such a stereotype. And I was tempted to say, no, it's not. it sounded like but they stripped a teaching moment, because in that moment, They could talk about the collard green is native to Africa. Okay, most of these recipes in the South that we have were created by the slaves, and now they're everywhere. So you ruin a teachable moment when you get caught with some of the thin-skinnedness when it comes to stereotypes. So I think we can begin to talk about those things, and I think that will help open up a dialogue.
Leslie Joy Allen is an historian and oral historian at Georgia State University. She's a doctoral candidate there. Thanks so much for coming in and giving us this time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so very much.